Hello everyone, good morning, good evening, good afternoon. This is Thomas Rickert speaking, the GMS Oral appointed co-chair to the CCWG, and I would like to welcome everyone to this call number 75 on the 7th of January 2016. We have a couple of substantive discussions in front of us. As discussed previously, this is going to be a call of 3 hours length maximum. We are going to go through the first three agenda items now, and after that we're going to have a 10-minute break. It can be a little bit longer depending on what the feedback from the group is, and after that we will reconvene for the two remaining substantive discussions and the AOB. As usual, we would like to do the roll call based on the remote participation room, and therefore I would like to ask you whether you have any updates to statements of interest. I'm sorry, whether there's anyone on the audio bridge only who is not in the Adobe. So there doesn't seem to be anyone on the audio bridge only, which is why we're going to take the participants from the AC room. Let me also know whether there are any updates to statements of interest. There don't seem to be any. And since there are some comments in the chat that there is an echo, maybe it's because I'm working from inside a cave. But no, actually, there shouldn't be an echo from my side. I have all my speakers muted. But for everyone else, can you please ensure that your lines are muted when not speaking? With that, I would like to hand over to my fellow co-chair, Mathieu, for the first substantive discussion.
Thank you very much, Thomas. This is Mathieu Bay speaking. Welcome to this call number 75. The first substantive item in first reading on our agenda today is recommendation one. You have received a document that highlights the main discussion points, and that the first one is the inspection rights discussion. As you know, this has been a very important aspect of the community empowerment discussion. And it's been recognized that there is an important need for the community to access relevant information if it wants to be in a position to make informed decisions about the community powers. And the inspection rights were part of our deliberations when deciding to move from the sole member to the sole designator model. We have received quite a lot of support for that, but a concern that was raised by the ICANN board, which we do understand as a concern that ICANN might be overwhelmed or at least receiving many requests, which would lead to a requirement to dedicate a significant amount of resources to managing those requests to the prejudice of the ability to operate normally. And we have also, in the meantime, between the publication of the third report and the closing of the public comments, received a memo from our lawyers. And if you go on the document, and probably if we can have the document for recommendation one on the screen, that would be very useful. If you go to paragraph 22, which is on page, okay, you have scroll control, which is on page 5 of the document, you will see that we have pasted in the document an extract from the board comment in brackets, and another extract from the lawyer's memo in another bracket to have the concrete proposals before our eyes before we discuss. If we to organize this discussion, there are three discussions to have on recommendation one that we'll take one by one. First one is about the scope and limitations of the inspection rights. Those are certainly useful things to clarify. The second one is a discussion on what are the criteria to within which the sole designator would be taking decisions to use these inspection rights. And the third one is not related to inspection rights, and it's more of a placeholder at this point that regarding recommendation one, we need to make a note of concerns that were raised regarding the role of the GAC as a decisional participant as well, and we need to also take note of the GAC input that we've received on this question. But it's probably not going to be something we can fully discuss at this point. So those are the three items to discuss. Those were my introductory remarks. In terms of scope and limitations of the inspection rights, the lawyer memo actually provides some useful clarifications that inspection rights do only apply to certain types of documents, which are the books and records of accounts and minutes of the member meetings, which do not have any relevance in our case. And so we have been provided by lawyers some clarifications on that, which we could certainly usefully insert into our report, and that would address some of the lack of clarity concerns from the ICANN board. And on this part and this part only, I'd like to check whether there are any questions or concerns with that approach to clarify what the scope and the limitations of the inspection rights are about. I'm seeing some support in the chat at this point on this. Jorge, your point on the admissibility of the GAC to the empowered community is going to be on our third sub-item, I'd say. I don't know if we have Bruce in the room or any other board member to comment on. Yes, you are, Bruce.
I'm here, yes, but not sure what other board members are on. One of the things on the inspection rights that when we looked at it was the text in the Californian law is really just a single sentence, and it doesn't really define terms. So it mentions minutes of meetings, which I think is pretty straightforward, and then it mentions accounts. And so accounts in a draw form, I think traditionally that's basically a ledger book. You know, like before you had online accounting systems, you would have basically gone into an office and you would see a written ledger. And a written ledger basically gives you the who you've paid and where you've received income from, and that's basically all it is. So I think part of why we wanted to provide a bit more clarity is we're expecting that that's not just what the community is expecting, because we can obviously do the equivalent of that. I can use an accounting system called Great Plains, and we could literally give you, as part of those inspection rights, the right to look at the general ledger, which will have a whole bunch of account codes, and it will give you the name of the supplier, and the if we've paid somebody, and the name of the payee if we've received income from someone. I doubt that really helps in any way, and so that's why we're trying to provide actually more than that, but actually provide some basis for how requests are made and the topics that those requests are made about, and actually provide, you know, essentially produce documents that provide the information that might be required by the community to make a decision. So that's really what we're trying to do, is actually not limit rights, we're actually trying to make them useful.
Thanks a lot, Bruce. Probably the ideal way forward on this would be based on the text provided by the lawyers to check whether additional clarity on the extra amount of transparency the board would be prepared to provide could be added into this text. Because what I'm sensing is that the minimum inspection right description is okay, and there's even more that the board is prepared to provide. And if we can capture this in the document, that's going to be even better. Is that an appropriate way forward?
Probably the way forward, I think, Matthew, and again, maybe this comes into bylaws drafting, but we've got to be looking at this not as it would be looked by a California court. We've got to look at this as it would be looked by an independent review panel, which may not even have any lawyers from California on it. And so I think probably the key is we need to be able to define the terms. And I think if we can define the terms a bit more clearly in the bylaws, then I think we perhaps have a better way forward.
Thanks, Bruce. So I think this definition of terms was an attempted by our lawyers. So probably if the and that was not a material that the board was able to fully consider because it was provided slightly after publication of the third report. So probably just a review on this should enable us to find a way an appropriate wording. Is that okay?
I know I've got other board colleagues looking at that, but we'll continue to provide feedback. But I suspect if your response is you think what you've got is good enough, I don't think that's where the board's at. So I think what we need to do is perhaps look at maybe providing some specific red line text that we think might address our concerns in your final report.
Okay. Thank you very much, Bruce. I think that's encouraging for this first item. The second item is actually raised by the question of what the type of support or conditions that would have to be met for the sole designator to consider to transmit a request of inspection to the ICANN board. The lawyer memo we had received was suggesting that this the sole designator would transmit requests when they are supported by one ASO or AC, and the ICANN board comment does suggest that this follows the same path as any other community power, with the level of support to get a community forum at two SOACs and a requirement to have at least three SOACs supporting this request. And I think that's a difference of view that we need to reconcile here. And I would like, I know, Jordan, I don't know if you're on the call. I noticed you made a contribution on this aspect on the list. Would you like to recap this?
Sure, I can do that. Can you hear me?
Yes, perfectly, Jordan.
Great, thanks. Hi, everyone. Jordan Carter, LMZ. I'm CCMSO, a member of the CWG for the record. All I said on the email list was that I thought that the two positions that had been mentioned, the lawyers and the boards, that the lawyers made more sense. The whole point of an inspection right of whatever sort is that it is about information gathering and it might be information that is relevant to the exercise of the other community powers. So to me, it makes no sense logically to set a very high threshold for the use of those powers. And that's about a relatively high threshold. Sorry, Matthew, I just need to go and get this call, which is probably our meeting, joining me through my room.
Okay. While you're taking the call, I'm seeing Alan's hand is up, and it would be interesting also to have a board member maybe explain the rationale behind the board's proposal on this aspect. Alan?
Thank you very much. Clearly, the answer to this depends on what exactly what we have inspection rights to. The more sanitized things are that we can actually get our hands on, I think, in my mind, reduces the threshold we should have to pass to get it. So the two are somewhat linked. My position is somewhat in between what we originally said and what Jordan is supporting, and at least what he supported in his email, and what the board is requesting. I think going through the full-fledged three-step process is overkill by a large amount. Now, we're also talking about shortening that process by combining steps. And again, if we shorten the process, then there's an iterative thing that we're going to have to look at. But the one thing that I don't think is reasonable, and I'm giving this as a personal opinion, this is not an ELAC position, we haven't discussed it. The one thing that I think is unreasonable is to allow a single AC or SO, and particularly one of the registry SOs, to request things. Among the few things the California law is clear on, according to our lawyers, is that this shouldn't be something for essentially commercial or business purposes. And in both cases of those SOs, they are either controlled by or almost completely controlled by specific business interests. So I think having them make the request gets us into a very shady area. So I think we need at least two ACs or SOs to allow this to go ahead, and perhaps an AC and an SO or something like that to get out of the business aspect of this. So I think the board is overreacting, but I think ours is somewhat too liberal and leaves it open to misuse. Thank you.
Thank you, Alan. Jordan, would you like to close your intervention before we move to the rest of the queue?
If I could, that would be great. Thanks, Matthew. Can you hear me this time?
Yes.
Right. Okay. Thanks. So what I was saying was that I supported the lawyer's approach because, as a matter of principle, this power should be easier to use than any of the other community powers. It isn't really a power. It's a sort of added benefit that came with the membership package that we moved away from on the understanding, as discussed very explicitly in Dublin, that this would be incorporated as part of the compromise. It's impossible to see this particular power as being on the same level as the others. That's not to say we don't need to work out an implementation framework, but that is an implementation detail to make it workable. And in the practical sense, I don't agree with Alan in what he just said. None of the SOs or ACs are going to use this power frivolously to get any of the councils involved. I mean, you look at the complexity of GNSO decision-making. You look at the slowness of CCNSO decision-making. Certainly the registries are no threat here. And as long as we've got a proper protocol worked out about how this should operate, which we've all said we need, it doesn't make sense to me to set two hoops or two SOs and ACs to exercise it. That's putting it on the same level as the other accountability powers, which doesn't have any logical coherence to it in my mind. Thanks, Matthew.
Thank you very much, Jordan. I have Edward and Greg on the list and would like to encourage board members to chime in. I see Sharon on the list. Thank you very much, Sharon, to have the board perspective as part of our deliberations. Thank you. Ed first.
Thanks, Matthew. I agree with Jordan. One of the things we need to be sure that we do with inspection is to keep everything pretty simple and keep the language and the bylaws simple as well. So when we attempt to use and exercise this power, which is going to be used, for example, when we expect fraud, when we expect impropriety, We don't want to allow the board, or the staff for that matter, be able to twist the language. For example, in the board proposal, the words related to the exercise of the community powers. As a lawyer, I can tell you that you give me any request. I can use that language, twist it, turn it, and delay it. We need to have bylaw language with inspection that's simple, to the point, so that can be used. That also goes forward in terms of who can request an item. I want to bring an example in recently from a DIDP I did last year. This was for portions of a contract that ICON had with a company called Westlake. And those of us in the GNSO wanted to make a representation that perhaps the work product didn't comply with the contract. And ICON wanted to give us this information. So Sam Eisner and I worked together. I filed the DIDP. I got what I asked for. By making it too complicated, by making two SOs have to bind together, to make the community mechanism have to come into play at first instance, eliminates the ability of ICON and the community to work together for the community to get information or a single SO to get information. Now, all agree we should have that no one's opposed to. So the lawyer's proposal, the proposal worked out by our experts in California law, is simple. It is to the point. And it would allow the bottom-up community access to information. And then if ICON says, heck, no, that's not appropriate, then we trigger the community mechanism. I think that's a lot simpler, a lot easier to operate, and a lot less bureaucratic, and that's why I support it.
Thank you very much, Ed. Before turning to Greg, I would note a comment by Holly that said that if the requested information is reasonable and related to community power right, then Alan's concern about improper use of inspection rights is addressed. And my understanding of the legal memo was that there could be a way to implement this by saying that by providing some ability to monitor improper use for business for business purpose in the way we implement the power, the inspection rights, I should say. Greg, you're next.
Thank you, Matthew. And I'll kind of follow on what Holly said there. First, I think you slightly misquoted what she said. I think she may have mistyped slightly, too. I think she meant to say that if requested information is reasonably related to a community power or right, Alan's concern is addressed. So in any case, I just want to say that I think Alan's concern is based on an overbroad misreading of the advice from counsel. I would certainly invite counsel to actually speak up. And I think as a general matter, this speak only when called on rule that we seem to have with counsel is kind of silly, but I digress. And I think, you know, further that the idea, as several have said, that somehow, you know, these are just a bunch of commercial puppets sitting in the GNSO, you know, is troublesome, especially that, you know, we're controlled by the contracted parties. There are obviously, you know, structural issues that are way out of scope of this discussion that we could discuss, but I don't think that in any way disqualifies the GNSO or the CCNSO from, you know, initiating a request for inspection. And I think it might be helpful to have Holly clarify it. My understanding, which may also be a misreading, is that we're talking about, you know, using an inspection right to gain a particular business advantage for a particular business, you know, vis-a-vis its relations to ICANN in some fashion, and not the fact that it somehow may be commercial in the broader sense, since, you know, like it or not, there is a very commercial aspect to the entire domain name system. Thanks.
Thank you, Greg. And I think we have discussed already that the scope of the inspection right anyway is limited to accounting books and records of the corporation and the minutes and of proceedings of the board of directors and committees of the board. So I think we already have quite a narrow space. Charin, to give us the board perspective, Charin.
Thank you, Matthew. Can you hear me?
Yes, perfectly.
Okay, so I want to give you a bold perspective on why it mentioned two SOs and ACs as a minimum. The idea was that the board saw the inspection right as a community power, not a designator model power. So it's not a designated power, it's a community power. And also so that this community power is tethered and goes along with the other community powers. And as you said in your opening remark, is this information decision about the community power, how to improve that, how to support that. So if the community wanted to exercise one of its powers, let's say veto the budget, but needed some more information, then that is fine because it goes together with that community power. And therefore, given that all the other powers are described so that there is a minimum of two SOs and ACs that should kick the process and then three SOs and ACs supporting or blocking, we felt that this should be married the same thing and goes along the same route. So that's for the, if you want, the accounting books and record that you mentioned. But the board also supported additional information and said, for example, if there are concerns and there's a need to investigate any potential fraud or mismanagement, financial mismanagement, it has nothing to do with the other powers, that the board would also support another process where a third-party firm could be retained that could undertake all the investigation required by the committee, by the community, and then would publish to the community the findings and the information that the community required. So that was the rationale from which the board came. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman. And indeed, I think we did not mention that part of the board comment, which is quite useful, and it was a sort of a proposal for an additional right. I think it was an investigation right to be awarded to the community to trigger an investigation, and that's something we'll need to capture at some point in our discussions. Can I just check with you, Chairman, whether you have clarity on the rationale on this on those who spoke earlier that feel that there's a need for an SO or AC when it's kickstarting a process, probably to access information with a slightly lower level of support or consensus at the beginning of the process? Is that something that's clear?
Yes, can I respond? Yes, I heard it clearly, but it didn't come across to me that this inspection right is aligned and associated and tethered with the other powers. So it felt like if someone wanted something, irrespective of exercising the powers that were agreed and transferred to the community, they should be able to do so. And the board felt that this it wasn't exactly what the board felt it's the right way of going about it, and that the inspection right should be attached and tethered with the community powers. And in addition, there was something separate, which is the inspection facilities in case there is a fraud investigation or something else.
I can comment also, Matthew, when you're ready.
Yes, yes, please, Bruce.
Yeah, I just thought the example that Edward gave was instructive because he was talking about looking at the terms of the contract and presumably what the performance requirements were in the contract of whether an external party had delivered on their contract. The accounts won't actually tell you that. The accounts will tell you how much we paid that supplier. And so that's kind of an example of really one is accounting requirements, which we could certainly tell you how much we paid that supplier. But I think he's really talking about wanting to have a document inspection right, and based on that document inspection right, being able to complain about whether that contractor had done their job properly or not. So it's just an example of different things. I think the reason why there's thresholds, and I think an earlier speaker sort of it might have been yourself, Matthew, but the balance here is between what information is requested versus what's the threshold to request that information. So I think if we're purely talking about the accounting records,
actually, I think a threshold of a single SOAC was reasonable. I think the second part that Shireen talked about was to say, if there is a fraud or a much deeper investigation, which in the equivalent of a sort of police level investigation, that you would have a higher threshold to initiate that, and then you would use an external party to come in and investigate the matter and identify if fraud is occurring.
Thanks, Bruce. So what you're saying is that maybe we could sort of find some common ground with a lower threshold for purely the accounting books and records and the minutes, which are largely already available anyway, and the higher threshold as described by the board comment for this new investigation right power, which I must say was a very constructive proposal, which is actually adding to the accountability mechanisms discussed by this group with a new interesting layer. So that sounds to be quite an interesting way forward, and I have Holly in the queue for maybe some clarification that I have. Apologies if I have misquoted you, Holly.
No, you've gotten it absolutely correct, Matav, in characterizing our advice, and Greg as well. And I would say, just in listening to the exchange with Bruce, I wonder how much maybe there's been some confusion by using the term inspection right. It sounds kind of like an investigation, but the California Code concept of an inspection right was simply the right to ask for and receive certain books and records, large accounts, and on board and board committee minutes. I don't think there was a contemplation of the kind of investigation powers that Bruce has raised, but which would clearly be very helpful to the community at a time where there were concerns about significant financial fraud. So agree that if the board's willing to go to that, that would be a wonderful thing for the community to have, but it was not what would have been included in the inspection rights under a California Code approach, where we were trying to mimic what members' rights would have had in a designator system.
Thank you, Holly. Greg, I think that's an old hand, if I'm not mistaken. Yes, so that's Caboose and Steve, and then we'll try to wrap this up. Caboose. Caboose, if you're speaking, we can't hear you. Okay. Caboose is either muted or having an audio issue. You made a suggestion to categorize the inspection. Indeed, that's the way forward I was describing between the basic inspection and the new sort of investigation right that the board is describing, which have different thresholds. So that was your suggestion. I think we're in line with this. While Caboose is maybe fixing the audio issue, can we go to Steve? Steve?
Thank you, Matthew. Steve Del Bianco with the CSG. On the assumption that we were seeking to give the designator same statutory rights that a member would have had under 6333, the scope derives from the language, but the support level is something we have to be more on. If, in fact, we were a member, a sole member, that sole member would have been the only one who could have exercised the 6333 inspection rights. So if we want to give the same rights in bylaws to the sole designator, then what would it be the structure that you use to generate support of the sole member? That is why earlier in this discussion, I was watching the chat, and there were several folks who were amazed at the idea that the sole designator would have to meet certain thresholds in exercising the power of inspection. But that's being consistent with giving bylaws rights that were similar if we had been a sole member. Because if we're a sole member or a sole designator, and as a single entity, we still have to find a way to gauging the level of support, making sure there's not too many objections to exercise of power. So there's no effort to constrain it any more than it would be constrained if we had all along succeeded at getting what we wanted, which was a member power. We would still be having a conversation on how do we know when the member has sufficient support to exercise the document inspection rights. Let's just try to remember that perspective. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Steve. Thomas Cavu, sorry, you appear to be satisfied by the answer that I provided. So if I want to recap, I can say that we would try and update the document to encapsulate the low threshold for inspection rights on accounting books and records and minutes, and then capture the investigation right proposal from the board with the higher threshold as proposed by the board as an extra paragraph, and also make mention of the need to for the implementation to make sure that vexatious claims or abusive claims are being handled properly. And Cavus is back with his hands up. So, Cavus?
No, thank you very much. That's okay with
okay.
me. If you categorize, that's okay. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for the suggestion, Cavus. I think it's very, very useful. Good. So we'll move forward as this is going to be our sort of first reading conclusion, and we'll update the document along these lines. The last item in this agenda point is a note that about recommendation number one. We have received formal GAC input, consensus input from the GAC that indicates that the GAC is intending to participate to the escalation phase. There were, however, and that was in line with the minority view submitted by Robin, some comments asking for the board, expressing concerns about the GAC being a decisional participant. So that's part of recommendation one, potential updates. Our suggestion at this point, until we receive formal GAC input, is not to go into deeper discussions on this at this point. And that's, I think, it has been planned for further discussions later in our deliberations on the comments. I just wanted to make that note so it's clear that this inspection right discussion is not the only aspect of the discussions on recommendation number one. And I see Robin's hand is up. Robin.
Thank you. Can you hear me okay?
Yes. Please, Robin.
Okay. Thanks. Yeah. I just wanted to raise a little bit of caution about what will happen to our proposal if we have to go before the Congress or the NTIA, and what we've done is we've changed GAC's role to a decisional authority with respect to the community powers. I think that we might be undermining the entire accountability proposal and perhaps even jeopardize the a speedy transition by going too far, by giving GAC the option to be a decisional authority with respect to the community powers. So I think that even those who might be comfortable with doing that from a philosophical or substantive viewpoint might want to take a look at it from a practical perspective, and we might want to reconsider the extent to which, particularly in light of the additional empowerment given to governments under Recommendation 11, the extent to which we may really need to pull back what we've done on Recommendation 1 and giving GAC a decisional powers or decisional authority with respect to the community powers. Thanks.
Thank you, Robin. And I think you're starting to kickstart exactly the discussion that I announced would be taken further down the road of our deliberations in another meeting. That has raised Cavus' interest, and Cavus, you'll have the floor. But yes. I think after that we'll close and acknowledge that this discussion that took place already in our deliberations will be taken on later on. Cavus?
Yes, as you have properly mentioned, we have to wait until the GAC take a more formal position, and that will be after 22nd of January. So if we want to discuss this issue again, it should be at the time that we have received that. Second, to my distinguished friend, Robin, there is a big difference between the Commendation 1 and the Commendation 11. There are two different teams. One is talking about the advice, the other is talking about exercising the power. There are many things to discuss. I prefer not to discuss it at this stage. But I give one simple example. Suppose that Article 11 relating to the GAC is going to be changed. And if you do not allow the GAC to exercise its power, GAC should accept whatever other community decide for that. I don't think it is fair, Robin. So you should reconsider. You insistently continue to oppose to any action taken by GAC. I refer to the government. There is no further additional role of the government. They prefer to remain advisory. But if their rights are touched or at stake, they should have the right to come in and express their views, and they should be heard. So I think we should maintain this multi-stakeholderism, but not exclude anything. But once again, let us wait for the GAC, and they come after 22nd of January. But please, Matthew, if you want to plan any other meeting, it should be after you receive the GAC formal position, if any. I don't know whether they would be in a position to have a formal position or not, but I cannot agree at this stage that before 22nd, you rediscuss that. You have to wait. Thank you. And thanks, Robin, for your insistence that GAC should have no role at all in the entire community. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Cavus. We'll not get that any further. I will conclude on this item to answering one point in the chat to avoid any confusion. The inspection rights are just what we've been discussing. The document information disclosure policy, the famous DIDP, is accessible not for the sole designator or the SOACs, but for everyone, and it's a fully other process, which is not a community power process. So we should not confuse those two in our deliberations, and probably we'll try to make this very clear in the document as well. And I think with that, we've covered some useful grounds on recommendation one already. And I will now turn to my fellow co-chair, Leon, for recommendation two. And let's escalate into recommendation two, Leon.
Thank you very much, Matthew. This is Leon Sanchez. And recommendation two is the one about engagement, escalation, and enforcement. And so far, we have received some comments about the different deadlines and the different periods of escalation throughout this process. And we have heard that some of them, or maybe all, could be a little bit tight. So the key discussion points for this part of the call would be those that we have at the top of the document that we circulated earlier. And the first one is to address the concern expressed by many that the escalation timelines are too tight and aggressive. And for this, we could explore four options, being the first one, notice and opportunity to comply extend periods. The second one, extension of deadlines. The third one, empowerment of councils or chairs for the initial steps. And the fourth one, we could also explore the removal of certain process steps. This would mean to simplify the process as it stands in our third draft proposal. And, well, what we need to do now is exactly discuss how we could do this or which of these four alternatives would be most suitable to address the concerns on the tight timelines that have been established. And one thing we need to keep in mind is that while we don't want to have very long timelines in the process, because of course we need to have an expedite process to exercise the powers, we also don't want to have such tight timelines that would not enable fair and inclusive participation from all SOs and ACs involved in this process. So I'd like to handle the floor to, well, of course, we'll go through the other points, which are discussing the ANAC objection to thresholds adjustment in case the number of decisional participants is lower as depicted in paragraph 62 in page 12 of this document, and of course discuss the board suggested amendments related to the threshold percentage as a basis in case the number of SOs and ACs would change, and this is in page 11. And the fourth discussion point would be discuss the concerns raised about equal weight between all SOs and ACs, which has been also a subject that has been long discussed and widely discussed among the CCWG. So I would like to handle the floor to Jordan Carter, which has been the rapporteur for this working group, and he'll be able to walk us through the different alternatives. And of course, after this, I would open the floor for comments and questions to the rest of the group. So Jordan, could you please take the floor?
Sure. Can you hear me?
Yes, we do.
Right. Thanks. Hi, everyone. Jordan Carter, .nz here again. So I think what Leon has asked me to do is just talk about the four options under number one in the paper in front of you, which is how we deal with the concern about timeframes. You'll recall earlier on, I think, in our work, we were talking about 15-day deadlines for a range of these steps. And then in Dublin, we hugely expanded the number of steps involved in exercising any of the community powers. And so we face a kind of dilemma, if you like. If we keep short deadlines on lots of steps, we may make it impossible for SOs and ACs to participate properly, to consider the decisions that they need to make, and so the powers may become just imaginary because no one can use them. On the other hand, if we extend the deadlines to a long and generous set of deadlines for each step, and there are lots of steps, then it could take 18 months to use any of these powers if we did it in a very long-winded way, or even a large number of months that's not as extreme as 18 months. So I think the question that we face is how to reconcile those two tensions, to give enough time to each SO and AC to make the consideration and decisions on the exercise of the powers, and to without blowing out the total time frame that it takes to use any of these powers. And the paper from the co-chairs sort of talks about four ways to do that. Sort of notice an opportunity to comply with extended periods, which I think is about just making sure that people are aware of a coming decision as early as possible and can start setting up their decision-making within the SOs and ACs early. There's extending the actual deadlines, which probably realistically we will need to do. There's the empowerment of councils or chairs for the initial steps, which I think is to suggest that the chairs of an SO or AC, as an example, could be the people who made a decision about a conference call rather than going through the full decision-making process of each SO or AC. And the fourth suggestion is the removal of certain process steps or a simplification. So, and that could be any of the ones that we've done. It could be the merging, for example, of some of the steps. So, having looked at all those and the feedback that I've seen, the most likely or the most reasonable impression that I've got is that merging the conference call and forum steps might be the way to go ahead. And we're going to have to lengthen some of the deadlines anyway. And when we're thinking about this whole escalation process, it's really important to remember that none of these powers, I don't think, is suddenly going to emerge out of the blue. If there's a concern with the whole ICANN board, for example, or if there's a concern with the budget, these concerns will already be apparent in the community, and people across CSOs and ACs will already be speaking with each other. So it isn't entirely obvious that we need to turn every step in that discussion into a bureaucratic, bylaws-based process with deadlines and timeframes that everyone needs to meet, because we know intuitively that some of the conversations will already be happening. So just to finish off my introductory point, to me, the most logical way to go is to merge the forum and the conference call steps. So if there's a threshold reached to invoke a community power, in other words, if a petition happens, you can rely, I think, on that SO and AC having spoken with other SOs and ACs to see if there's some interest in using the power. And then you can move to a community forum where there's a full discussion among the community. And in doing those things, you can lengthen the timeframes. You might be able to get up to 30 days to allow a petition and another 30 or 40 days to get to the decision point with a forum held in the middle of that. So we have a slightly longer time frame in place for people to make the decisions after due consideration, and we acknowledge the reality of informal discussion, but we don't try and set out every step with long deadlines in a way that means it takes 6 months or so to exercise any of the powers. And with that, I'll hand back to you, Leon.
Thank you very much for this intervention, Jonathan. And I see Caboos hand is already up. So, Caboos, I know that you have made a couple of comments in the chat box, but please do take the floor and please comment on what we are discussing.
No, I give up my time and give it to the others. My comment is already in the chat. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Caboos. And at this point, I would like to open the floor, as I said, for comments. I see Alan Grimberg's hand is up. Alan?
Thank you very much. I'll just note, and someone can answer along the way if it's important. Item 1C says empowerment of councils. I understand what empowerment of chairs means, but empowerment of councils, I would have thought the councils and the committees are the only groups with any power to begin with, so I'm not sure what change that would imply. However, with regard to what Jordan is proposing, at least as I understand it, of merging the things, I think we specified, I think we were micromanaging and specifying the detail level that we already did, and I certainly have no problem with compressing it somewhat, or at least eliminating the detailed stages and providing a similar overall amount of time to make the decision. My only concern is without the what we're calling the conference call, we need to make sure that as we go forward with the single community petitioning, how that information gets socialized and spread to the others. Otherwise, we will call the community forum and no one will attend because they really don't understand what's going on at that point. So we just need to make sure that we have reasonable processes, not necessarily laid out in the bylaws, but reasonable processes to socialize the intent to exercise a power. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Alan. And I see Caboos, your hand is up, so I just want to double check whether you want to comment because I don't want to skip you. Oh, now your hand is down again, so I assume that you give up your time. So maybe one way forward is to try and include in the recommendation to socialize the topic, of course, and distribute the relevant material before the community forum is held. And we could do these in the next draft or the next amendment to the proposal. And we could also go forward with Jordan's approach. So we would be preparing an amended document for everyone to review and discuss it in our next call that will be addressing this recommendation. So the next point of discussion is the discussion on the ALAC objection to the thresholds adjustment in case the number of decisional participants is lower. So for this, I would like to handle the floor maybe to Alan Greenberg, so you could provide the group with the ALEC's position as to this objection from the ALEC, so we can, of course, further discuss with other members and participants. Alan, would you be able to provide us with the ALEC's position to this issue?
Yes, certainly. Just for the record, I'll note that the comment on page, I think, 13 of the document distributed, that comment W4 incorrectly describes the ALEC's position. The ALEC said we could not support reducing the count, the threshold count, for removing the entire board. We said we explicitly support it for one of the powers, and that we have concerns with the other powers. The power that we supported it for was changing fundamental bylaws, and because we also had a concern that it would be too hard to change the fundamental bylaws, and we could consider it for the other two, but we didn't actively support it. Okay, so our concern, which, by the way, is not only expressed by the ALEC, the board also said quite clearly that they could not accept lowering the threshold for removing the entire board. At least that's the way I read their comment. So it's not just the ALEC. Removing the entire board is about as revolutionary as one can imagine, and that simply has to be something which is going to be supported by a reasonable part of the community, and reasonable in our case, I believe, four is reasonable. On top of that, we also pointed out that as worded, the recommendation makes really little sense, because it says that if three ACs or SOs supported removing the board, one of them objected and one abstained, the power would go forward and the board would be removed. On the other hand, if all five participated, but two of them abstained, it would not go forward. I'm sorry, if only three participated and supported it and two abstained, it would not go forward. That says a power can be exercised by three ACs and SOs with one objection, but cannot be exercised by three ACs and SOs with no objections. That's just doesn't make a lot of sense. So I think the idea, although I understand why it came about, was not well thought out. It results in something which is, just in my mind, doesn't make a lot of sense. And on top of that, I think it's exercising a crucial power with far too small a part of the community. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Alan. Are there any other comments in regard to this issue? I see Tijani Benjamin's hand is up. Tijani?
Yes, thank you, Leon. Tijani speaking. I think that removing the entire board is an earthquake, if you want. It's something that will be really, really serious. And we don't have to reduce the threshold for this kind of power. I think that even the unanimity would be good, but not reducing it to three. This is something that we cannot accept in this for this power, but also for the other powers. I didn't agree with the rationale of this modification, because they say there is only four participating. No, one is abstaining, and an abstention is a participation. So I believe that we don't have to change our first document as it was done for the final document published. We have to stick to the threshold we had before. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Tijani. Next on the queue, I have Andrew Sullivan. Andrew?
Hi. Reluctant as I am to take everyone's time, I'm just concerned that we're attempting narrowly here to apply a two-value logic to a three-value system. If you have a positive support, abstention, and negative support, what you have is a three-value system in which you have to count up the positive support in favor of things. And people often say, well, abstentions count as negative. That's not actually true. What it is that the abstention doesn't count as positive. And so what you're requiring is positive support. And if you don't get that positive support, then for whatever reason, the motion or the objection or whatever it is we're talking about doesn't pass. So I think there's been a little bit of confusion in the discussion about this. I personally don't actually care how this works out. But if what you're going to say is that people can abstain, and you're not going to count only positive support as the necessary condition for passing, then you've just got this confused system in which you've effectively got really only two values, but you've got a three value system. So I think that you've got to have the positives only. And what Alan has argued is that three positives in the presence of an objection should obviously be more powerful than simply 3-4. I don't agree. The question is merely, do you have positive support or not? And if the answer is no, then you failed to meet the threshold. That's all there is to it. But it's once you've introduced abstention as a possibility, it's a three-value logic system, and you can't try to apply two-value logic rules to it.
Thank you, Andrew. Next in the queue, I have Jordan Carter.
Thanks, Leon. Jordan here. The scenario that gave rise to this was not so much an abstention. I think we've all accepted that SOs and ACs may decide to support the use of a community power, to object to its use, they may decide to abstain. The issue was more trying to deal with a situation where they couldn't decide anything at all. Now, we haven't really defined in our system whether you have to do something to record an abstention, i.e. whether abstaining itself has to be a positive act. But the fear here was that with a threshold of 4 to remove the board, should you require unanimity? And the answer of the CCWG has always been that you shouldn't require unanimity. And the fear was, as an example, and this isn't the only example, if the GAC was a decisional participant and couldn't by consensus arrive at any kind of decision, should that mean, on the question of whether to remove the board, should that mean that all of the other parts of the ICANN community had to be unanimous or not? Now, it's a relatively unlikely, I think, scenario to come to, but that's what it was designed to address. And that's why it was included in the third draft proposal. Now, I think that the logic stands up. I don't think it's a do-or-die issue. But I just wanted to assert why we did this in the first place. That's the kind of scenario it was designed to deal with. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Jordan. Next, I have Steve DelBianco.
Thanks, Leon. I'm picking up on what Jordan said in explaining the rationale of what we came up with in Dublin, and that was substantially the decision model and thresholds that made their way into our third draft report. The first is that we agreed in Dublin that we wanted to move to a strong support, showing of strong support in the absence of substantial objections. And that model is used by a few ACs and SOs today, and that was used to replace this notion of voting. Second, is that we anticipated that any AC or SO could pick one of four ways to participate. It could support the exercise of the power, it could oppose, it could abstain, or it could simply advise the community of what it thinks. That, and again, we're advising the community in this case, not the board. The board's not even part of that. So those are your four alternatives. And finally, I wanted to mention that abstention could well be because of scope. As an example, the ASO might consider that the exercise of a power that's completely related to the naming functions of ICANN is outside the scope of the ASO. And they could, in that case, simply abstain. Not the best of outcomes, but I have to respect their decision to do so. That's one of the reasons that we cannot make these thresholds so high that they require the active participation of every single AC and SO that has said that they want the option to participate. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Steve. Alan Greenberg?
Thank you. With regard to what Jordan was saying of the GAC or somebody could not make a decision, I don't think we really want to or can psychoanalyze our ACs and SOs as to why they did not come up with an answer. Sometimes you don't come up with an answer because you can't come to a conclusion. Sometimes you simply run out of time. There's all sorts of reasons, and I really don't think we can start looking at the motives and assign a rationale for why someone gave no answer. I really think that's a dangerous road to go down. The latter point I made really says, how can you rationalize taking an action with three groups deciding to take it and one objection, but not taking the action if those same three groups decide and the other two abstain or they don't say anything? You're ending up there with almost strategic voting that, someone who wants to oppose it deliberately doesn't say no, because if they say no, it will go ahead. But if they don't say anything, it will not go ahead. It just defies logic, I'm afraid. But that's the implementation if you were to go with it for anything, and I think that would have to be addressed. In terms of board removal, I think it's too crucial an issue to take lightly and to lower the threshold, period. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Alan. Next on the queue, I have Jorge Cancio. Jorge, might you be on mute? We cannot hear you.
No?
Now we can hear you.
Okay. You hear me?
Yes, Jorge.
Okay, sorry. I was typing with my iPhone. I think the discussion on the thresholds and also the discussion we were having on the chat are somehow related, and I'm a bit sorry and deceived to a certain extent that we are coming back to discussions on the participation of the GAC as if the participation of the GAC would be a problem, would be a danger, would be something bad we have to avoid. We've been seeing and witnessing during these discussions that others pretend to be authorizing us or authorizing the GAC to participate or permitting the GAC to participate. Whether it's admissible for the GAC to participate, I think this is a bit sorry to hear these kinds of expressions. But going back to the concerns expressed by Alan, which are concerns which we have shared in the past, I would like to remind other colleagues that we are talking about the exercise of community powers. And that exercise of community powers only has a meaning and only is sensible if this exercise is really supported by the community at large. And if we lower the thresholds, it will be only a fraction of the community which will be exercising that community power. So it will not represent the community as a whole any longer. So I think that lowering the threshold is the first step to kick out of the community some parts of it, and we are seeing, and I've said it before, that there are very decided moves to kick out the gag from the exercise of the community powers, and this is all linked. So although perhaps the proposer, and I mean Jordan, may not have anything to do with this kind of intentions, this is laying the ground for this move. I think this would really undermine this exercise. It would lower the incentives for a high participation, and it would prepare the path and the way for decisions on very, very important issues, which would not be supported by a fair representation of the community, but only by a fraction of the community. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jorge. I see that we have in the queue Matthew Bale and Tijani Benjamin. I would like to close the queue after Tijani, and unless we have, of course, one board member that would like to comment on this point, as Alan has commented on the chat box, it would be especially useful to receive any feedback or any comments from any board member at this point. So should there be anyone from the board willing to speak on this point, please go ahead and do so. And next on the queue, I have my co-chair, Matthew Bale. Matthew?
Yeah, Sean, I'd like to be on the queue as well. Thank you.
I'm sorry, who was that?
This is Sean, for the record. I'm audio only. I'd like to be on the queue.
Okay, Sean, I will place you after Tijani. Matthew?
Yes, thank you. Thank you very much, Leon. And I think this debate is quite useful. And I hear agreement on the concern that the threshold for changing fundamental bylaws might be so high that it might create some difficulties in actually changing those bylaws in the future, which is a paralysis or lack of of ability to evolve as the sector changes that has been a concern in the past in our group. And the fundamental bylaw power is very special because it's a prior approval threshold instead of a veto threshold. So what I'm hearing is that we have agreement that this is a concern. One way to address this without going into the special case that we were describing in paragraph 62 would be to only lower this threshold to minus one, so three, and keeping the standard bylaws similar. So the standard bylaw is a veto power, and it needs three supporting the veto, which is likely to be, which is unlikely to block changes within ICANN. And the fundamental bylaw is a requirement to get approval, positive approval, by at least three and a maximum of one objection. And so I think we could that would still make a fundamental bylaw sufficiently hard to change, but also mitigate the risk of paralysis or inability to change as ICANN evolves in the future. So that would be, I think, a way forward considering the various arguments that have been discussed so far in this meeting. So that's the suggestion I wanted to make, Leon. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Matthew. And this suggestion seems to me very reasonable. And, well, of course, I would be calling for objections after finishing listening to the rest of the queue. So next on the queue, I have Tijani, and after Tijani, Shun, and with that, we will be closing the queue. Tijani, could you please take the floor?
Thank you very much, Leon. Tijani speaking. It seems that we are reconsidering our philosophy of Dublin regarding the threshold. We said, and I remember very well when I think Steve was writing on the board, we said that this is the threshold, whatever the vote is or whatever the position are. And now we are reconsidering that, saying that if we have abstention, it will change. But what is more strange is that we are considering one abstention, but not more than one abstention. So, in my point of view, the abstention is a position. And we said in Dublin we are considering the support and the objection only. The abstention is a position. And it is not participating. It is a participation by a position, which is the abstention. So it is not a support. It's not an objection. And we have to keep, in my point of view, we have to keep the threshold as it was decided in Dublin, and not change it. Because if we follow the same reasoning, we will have to decrease the threshold if we have two abstentions also. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Tijani. And last on the queue is Sean Ojedeji. Sean?
Yeah, hello? Can you hear me? This is Sean.
Yes, Sean, we can listen to you.
Oh, okay, good. Thank you. I just like to... also support what Jenny has said, and also to give perhaps a rationale for my reasoning. I think we need to recall that ISOs and ACs by themselves have diversities within them. And even before an ISO or AC can either indicate a support or against, there must have been some level of disagreement within each SO or AC. So it means that most likely those SO or AC that give support, they will never have achieved 100% unanimous among themselves. So that alone is some level of leverage that has been given. Now, at the level of exercising the power, further reducing the threshold means that we are entirely disconnecting a whole set of community, which in itself has its own diversity. So I think whenever we're considering use of this power, we should, as much as possible, avoid reducing thresholds. I am in total favor of unanimous for removing the entire board. Because that is what actually puts the ability to remove individual board members in practice. But again, since that is not widely supported, the four can still be manageable. But nothing less than that. And anything fundamental by law is also something critical. I don't see why the threshold for that should also be reduced. I think we should consider this very well and critically, so that we don't experience a disconnect of an entire community from this process ultimately. The other thing I want to comment on is on the participation. I understand that that has, did I get it right, that has actually indicated that they would participate in this process, in exercising the powers, if they have, I understand that the ASO has indicated as well, so it means that we already have five. Why are we still talking about this scenario of four? That's what I'd like to get clarification on. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Sean. And the way forward that I would suggest we take is that we as co-chairs redraft the document with the proposed amendment by Mathieu, and we would circulate this to the list and, of course, test the different views on this suggested amendment and discuss the proposal in the list so we can have
a better view on this issue as proposed by Mathieu. So with this, I would like to go to the next discussion topic, which is the concern raised by the board on their suggested amendments related to the threshold percentage as a basis in case the number of SOs and ACs would change in the future. And for this, I would like to ask some board member in this call to actually explain us their views on this issue. So someone from the board, could you please kindly...
Yep, I'm happy to talk to that one, Leon.
Yes, Bruce, please.
Yeah, the concept here is that we see that ICANN may evolve over the future. Who knows, we might even get an advisory committee on human rights, given the great interest in that topic on this list. And so the idea was just that rather than specifying thresholds with fixed numbers, whether it's three or four SOs, that in addition to that, it's probably useful to put in a percentage threshold as well that basically aligns with that number. So, you know, if currently we have the equivalent of 75% threshold, then that's also, say, you know, minimum of four or minimum of 75%, you know, whichever is greater or lower or whatever the right wording is. But it's just really just trying to take into account that the organisation will continue to evolve. ALAC, for example, wasn't an advisory committee when ICANN was created, nor was ESSAC, actually. So both of those were created subsequent to the creation of ICANN.
Thank you very much, Bruce. I note that Jorge Cancio's hand is still up, but I'm not sure if that's an old hand or a new hand, Jorge. Could you kindly confirm? Okay, so now it's now down. So next in the queue, I have Alan Greenberg. Alan?
Thank you very much. I did distribute a chart and emailed last night on the impact of using percentages. It may be worthwhile showing that. Among other things, it demonstrates that the percentages the board suggested would not work if we went down to four ACs and SOs instead of five. It does work reasonably well going up. However, I have no problem suggesting it as a default or something like that. If and when we actually add ACs or SOs, I think there needs to be a conscious decision on how the voting, the thresholds are impacted, not simply follow the prescribed percentage blindly. It's going to depend on the circumstances. We could have an advisory committee that might have very, very limited scope. And for some reason, we call it an advisory committee, but it's not of the same type as the others. And we might not want it to have that same level of control. We have had a case before, as Bruce said, things have changed. We used to have only one TLD SO, and it became the CCNSO and GNSO. The GNSO could split into multiple SOs in the future. And it might not be that we want the composite amount to be the majority of ICANN, the majority of the SOs, just because they have chosen for whatever internal reason to split. So I really think that we should not be casting things in concrete right now because we don't know the nature of the future ones. I have no problem with using it as a guideline or a default. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Alan. Next on the queue, I have Jordan Carter.
Jordan here. It's my pleasure to agree with Alan. I think that it should be a case-by-case decision, and I don't think writing percentages in or not writing percentages in is going to make any difference to the fact that people will use the numbers in the current table as a guide and as a reference point to start. So adding percentages doesn't add anything to that at all, and if the principle is that we should look at it on a case-by-case basis, which I support, which we'll have to do anyway, because we need to change the bylaws to incorporate any new decisional SOs and ACs. That's the way it should stand. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Jordan. So next on the queue, I have
Tijani, and I will close the queue with Tijani so we can move forward because we are approaching the break, the program break for this call. So, Tijani?
Thank you very much, Leon. I do agree with Alan, but I also agree with the board that we need to put something to say that this threshold has to change with the change of number of SOs and ACs in ICANN. But we will not impose a percentage. We need to say that it will evolve with the change of the number of the SO and ACs. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Tijani. So I think that a possible way forward would be for us coaches to draft a solution for this as per the suggestions that we have heard. And by this, I mean that we could have the percentage suggested as a default discussion basis, but we would also need to evaluate the different the different circumstances in which this situation should arouse, and we could also modify the thresholds as the case may be in case the number of SOs and ACs should change in the future. So I think this could be a proper way forward, and we would hold this task for the co-chairs and, of course, circulate the amended report for everyone to review. And I know that Steve Dobianco rose his hand. So, Steve?
Thanks, Leon. Picking up on this notion of adding or dividing ACs and SOs in the future, please keep in mind that if the organization were to create or divide ACs and SOs, that is a bylaws change, a regular bylaws change, and that would be subject under our entire plan, blocking by the sole designator. At the same time, as the language of that new AC and SO, if there's proposal to change the thresholds are part of the fundamental bylaws, whereby the sole designator must approve those changes. So we have already designed a mechanism by which adjusting the number of ACs and SOs and the thresholds themselves are already subject to the community's approval or blocking, and both with the mechanisms we have. So there's no need for percentages to be locked into the bylaws. We can make these decisions when the circumstances arrive. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Stephen. That seems reasonable, so I would say that we would be taking that into account at the moment of redrafting the formula for this in the report before we circulate it to the rest of the list to, of course, listen to the feedback that anyone would like to provide. So with this, I would like to move to the next discussion point. And maybe once again, I would like to call on the board representatives to check whether this approach that has been suggested is okay or in line with the views or concerns raised by the board. So, I don't know, Bruce, could you please signal us as to whether this approach would be addressing the board's concerns?
I think we need to just see the language. I haven't actually seen the proposed language, Leon, but we'll have a board call next week and then I can give feedback after that.
Okay. Thank you, Bruce. So the next discussion point is the concern raised about equal weight between all SOs and ACs. We can refer to page 11. And I note that one important hurdle for this discussion at this point is that we are still waiting to get the GNSO input, and this is, of course, of the essence, I think, for discussing this topic. So I would suggest, and as I wrote to Robin on the list, that we acknowledge that we have this issue pending, and that we, of course, discuss this issue when we get the GNSO input, so we can, of course, consider all the views from the different stakeholders
and the different comments from the different constituencies that have raised concerns as to this very important issue. So if we have no objections on this, I would defer this discussion for when we get the GNSO input. And at this point, we would be able to go into a break just in time as programmed. And at this point, would anyone like to do any comment? I see Jordan's hand is up, but I'm not sure if that's an all hand or a new hand, Jordan. Okay, so that was an all hand. Okay, so we have finished just in time for the break, and we will be reconvening in 13 minutes. That would be 15 minutes before the hour. So enjoy your break.
Yeah, but that's just for the, that's just for.
Hello, everyone. This is Thomas Rickert speaking. We have 15 minutes to the top of the hour, and I'd like the operator to get the recording restarted, please.
Recordings are started.
Thank you so much. And we would now like to continue our conversation with the next agenda item on another community power, which is the community power on budget. And we're talking about the IANA budget in particular. And in front of you on the screen, you see the four key discussion points on the budget community power, and we're going to discuss those one after the other. And I would suggest that I will do a quick introduction on the questions, including a way forward, and then we will try to seek confirmation with this group, and afterwards we're going to put in writing the agreed way forward so that we can further discuss it on the list if necessary and confirm the suggested way forward during the subsequent meeting. Now, the first point is to confirm the clarifications requested by the CWG regarding transparency, rationale, and the role of the CWG stewardship in elaborating the process for IANA budget. And this point you will find on pages 5 and 6 of this very document. And in fact, this is a point that has been included in our second report, but for reasons that I can't entirely recall at the moment, we have dropped this language. And the question is whether we are okay with reintroducing what is now paragraph 10 of this document in our final report. Do we have any opposition to reintroducing this point in our report? I will pause for a second to give everyone the opportunity to take a quick glance at it for those that haven't taken a look at it earlier. And Cavus's hand is raised. Cavus, the floor is yours.
Just I'm asking, have you considered the comment made by ICANN saying that in the budget of the IANA, the community involved in that and they outlined the four communities need to decide only but not other communities? What is your answer to that, and how either you could convince the board that no, it is the entire community who has the right to do that, and how Bruce could convince us that only those four categories that they have mentioned must be involved in the IANA budget rejection? Thank you.
Thanks very much, Cavus. And the point that you're raising is actually to be included in the second question that we're going to discuss after we have reached a conclusion on this question. So I'm confident, Cavus, that we will sufficiently cover that point in a moment. I'm seeing at least one comment in the chat that it makes sense to re-add what's now paragraph 10. And I have not seen any objection to the reintroduction of that language, and therefore I suggest we move on, including this what seems to be uncontroversial language in paragraph 10, and move to the second question to which Cavus already spoke, and that is to discuss and refine the role of the operational communities in the IANA budget veto, as suggested by the ICANN board, and taking into account the IAB-specific input, according to which the IAB does not want a direct voice, but it wants to still to be heard. If you take a look at page 6 and paragraph 22, you will even find the suggested way forward, in which I'm going to read out. It's not a lot of text, but it should respond to the point that Cavus raised during his latest intervention. And the suggested way forward could be to say, as an implementation instruction, in implementation, any process through which a portion or the whole of the IANA budget is subject to rejection must include the voice of the operational communities served by the IANA functions. These operational communities include the GTLD registries, RIRs, the CCTLD registries, and the IATF. The process must also be implemented in such a way as to ensure the stable and continuous delivery of the IANA functions. So by including that additional language in paragraph 22, we take note of the board's comments. We include the comments that you find in the markup section of this document. You will see the other groups that have chimed in on this point, and we hope that this is to everyone's satisfaction. There's a queue forming. And let's hear the first speaker, which is going to be Adam.
Thank you very much. I thought someone was ahead of me. I just wanted to make a brief comment that if IANA's budget is vetoed or if there's a substantial problem with it, that this is of concern to the entire community, not just those who have day-to-day interactions with IANA. So the concept that only the operational communities have a stake in this, I think is just downright false. So I just want to go on record as saying that. Thank you.
Thanks, Alan. Maybe just to clarify, we're talking about a community power here. So this is a matter for the whole community, so no one is excluded. We're just suggesting as an instruction to those that are going to draft the implementation language that when it comes to the IANA budget, the additional operational communities must also be heard. So this is actually not an exclusionary approach, but it is more inclusive.
Thomas, I was not critiquing what your language you're suggesting. I was commenting on the concept that I believe the board proposed that only the operational community should be involved in the decision. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much for that clarification, Alan. And just as a heads up, I would really like to invite one or multiple of the attending board members to comment on the suggested way forward, which we hope is capable of bridging the gap between the comments, the various comments, not only from the board that have been made. Izumi is next.
Hello, everyone. I just want to elaborate a little bit on the post I made about the numbers community, because we are considered as one of the operational communities. So in short, we believe that the third version of the CCWG proposal already sufficiently addresses our needs and involvement. We are able to participate in the process as the ASO, which the RIRs can also provide feedback as needed. And actually, our needs about the fees for the IANA numbering services is sufficiently addressed by the SLA to be exchanged between RIRs and ICANN. So we're actually happy with what's being proposed at the moment. At the same time, we don't necessarily oppose to language that would add additional involvement, participation by the operational communities, as long as it, by incorporating and making these changes, it would not affect the progress of our proposal or lead to a blocking factor by other SOs or ACs in approving this element of the proposal. So that's an observation from the ASO. Thanks.
Thanks very much, Izumi. We have Jordan, Andrew, Shireen, Kavuz, and after that, let's pause and try to take stock. Jordan.
Thanks, Thomas. It's Jordan here. Look, I thought this was a helpful intervention by the board in this proposal. And I think it reflects an earlier discussion in the WP1 where we did think about whether to give the decision rights over the IANA budget directly to the operational communities. But that didn't fly in the discussion there, which included those communities. And now it's clear from the IAB's comment that they aren't keen to have a decisional role, and the numbers community will already have one if it chooses to exercise it through the ASO, as Izumi's just described. And those pieces of feedback came in after the board lodged its comment. So I'm hoping, and maybe Bruce or Shireen or another director could tell us whether, in light of the desire by the IAB not to be a decisional participant on this budget, and the NRO comments, whether we're okay sticking with the status quo of the decision being made by the general system that we've developed here. I think that would be the easiest and least time-consuming way to approach this. Also, just as a point, the language in the paper in front of us, the recommendation for paper, isn't quite the same as what the budget, as what the board's comments said. Definitely, any of the operational communities will have the chance to comment and participate if they like in the community forum that would discuss any veto, because it's open to everyone, and hopefully they would make any views known if they had them. But what the board had specifically suggested was that decisions about the IANA budget be delegated to the four operational communities. And once again, I find myself agreeing with Alan and saying that I don't think that's quite the right way to go. So keen to hear from the board about what their thinking is at, given the new info that's come to hand.
Thanks very much, Jordan. Next is Andrew.
Hi. Thank you. So I'm pretty uncomfortable with paragraph 22 here. And so I noticed in the chat there was maybe a little bit of confusion about this, and so maybe people don't fully understand how this works. The relationship between between ICANN and the IETF, that is the IETF and the IANA operator, is basically managed and supervised by the IAB. So, so the IAB's comment about this was effectively that it doesn't want to be involved in direct negotiation about the budgetary matters of IANA. And the reason for that is because we already have an SLA. And so it's from the point of view of the IAB, ICANN is an IANA service provider. And just like if we were dealing with any other vendor, we do, like for instance, we deal with AMS to do the secretariat services for the IETF. We don't... you know, if they have an internal budgetary problem, we don't get involved in that. What we have is a question, you know, can you solve this? And under those circumstances, somebody would come back and say, oh, well, we've got a little problem because, I don't know, the bank went broke, and so there's, you know, bankruptcy, and it's going to take us 3 months before we can do this. Is that okay? And under those circumstances, that wouldn't be that wouldn't be, you know, that's the sort of thing that you do on a case-by-case basis. So I don't think we want to make rules about that. But what we don't want to do is get involved directly in the budget stuff itself. Instead, it's just a sort of, you know, can we take this variance from the contractual obligations or whatever? And that's the kind of thing I think is consistent with the IAB's comment, and that would be and that would be acceptable in the future. I will note that the IAB suggested a different approach in draft two, and I'll just draw this to people's attention, and I have to say I don't especially care which way you go. But the other approach that the IAB suggested was that the budget for the IANA operations be frozen from time to time, you know, with particular increases and work plans and so on, over the course of the lifetime of some agreement. So, for instance, the IAB and the IETF concludes a supplementary agreement with ICANN every year about the IANA functions, and so you could do that annually during the preparations, and you could say, well, you know, this is how the SLA is going to work, and this is what the preparations are, and then the community could review that and say, oh yes, well, we're okay with that, and then having already agreed to it. Now, I am currently living in the U.S., and I'm aware that in the United States, it isn't the case that once you've budgeted for a thing, you automatically pay for it if you're Congress. But everywhere else in the world, once you've already agreed to such an agreement, you know, you just presumably are budgeting for it, and that's just one of the things that you have. So that might be a thing that you could do and build into the caretaker budget, and that would be another way to solve it. So that was another thing that the IEB suggested in the comments to draft two. So that would be a way that we could tackle it. But I think that this paragraph 22, probably the IEB would not feel comfortable with this because it involves the IETF directly in discussion about whether the budget, how the budget goes and so on. And I think that that's not really the relationship that we have with ICANN.
Thanks, Andrew. Just a quick follow-up question for you. Would you like the language if we did amend it to the need to make sure that to take note of the views of the operational communities without specifying any of those?
Well, I think the key thing here, at least from the IETF's point of view, the issue is not what's the budget. The issue is what obligations does ICANN already have contractually? And that seems to be really from outside the corporation. I mean, if I pretend that I don't care at all about what goes on inside ICANN, because of course I have that hat too. But if I stand completely outside of it, this is a straightforward service provider arrangement, and so it isn't my views about what your budget are that ought to count, right? It's just can you deliver the service that you said you were gonna? And I think that maybe if this is couched in terms of assuring the contractual responsibilities of ICANN or the PTI or all of the above, then that might be a different way to tackle this, because that includes those views, right? Presumably, the IETF and either ICANN or PTI, wherever the arrangement ultimately winds up. The key point is that they've negotiated these things outside of that, and presumably the ICANN side has negotiated that in keeping with the budget that it knows it already has. Now, I agree that you want to protect against the case where, for some reason, ICANN promises to fund the IETF to the tune of $10 million a year. But I think if we have that problem, we got other kinds of issues too.
Thanks very much, Andrew. Shireen?
Yes. So let me tell you what the board perspective on this and where we're coming from. The idea was that we obviously agree with everything that has been developed with Jonathan and the community in terms of the veto power on the budget. And on the IANA one, we felt that the IANA is a service to certain customers, and it would make sense to involve those customers and give them the right to block the IANA budget if they wanted to. But I take, this is a personal comment, I take Alan Greenberg's comments into account, and also to point out to Andrew that even if the IETF, which I would say is the operational community, quote, external, there are others operational community internal within ICANN, they should also have a role in actually blocking the veto, blocking the IANA function. So I, on a personal level, would be comfortable with paragraph 22, and would also be comfortable if the word IETF is excluded from it, if that makes Andrew and the IETF happy with that.
Thanks very much, Shireen. Cavus is next, and then Bruce.
Yes, Thomas, I was in the middle of typing these things. I have no difficulty that for IANA budget we take a different approach. Our basic approach up to now was that the community powers were exercised by SO and ACs. Three of the four people mentioned by ICANN, they are already in SO and AC. The only one is not is IETF. If IETF directly or indirectly through IRB should be represented, then we may have a different approach for IANA budget, including a mixture of SOAC and operational community. But we could not limit it to just these four mentioned by ICANN board. Other community must also be in, plus IETF or IAB and so on and so forth. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Kaboos. Bruce? Bruce, you might be on mute. We can't hear you.
Yes, sorry, I am on mute. If I look at the first sentence, I think that sounds right, that certainly the input of the users is taken into account in the community decision process. I think the last sentence is probably the key one and might need to be enhanced a little bit, but I've noted in the chat forum, one of the things when we discussed it as a board was trying to understand how the caretaker budget fits into the broader ICANN budget. So if I give an example, it could be that the IANA function operator is requesting a series of face-to-face meetings around the world with all the users of the function and that they needed a $2 million additional budget for that. That's certainly something that you can imagine the wider community might say, well, is that the best use of our resources when we need to spend some money elsewhere? That's something that, to me, wouldn't be in a caretaker budget. But if there was a requirement to, I don't know, put in a firewall for improving the security to make sure we have secure and stable delivery of the IANA function, then that, to me, is something that could impact the actual stable and secure operation of the IANA function, and that wouldn't be something that should just be sort of treated on the same line of, okay, we don't want to put in a new firewall, we want to have a meeting of some other part of the ICANN community. So I think the key in the last sentence is really sort of elaborating that a little bit further, I think, and saying that there needs to at least be a caretaker budget part of the IANA function that allows it to deliver on its contracts and SLAs, as Andrew Sullivan mentioned, and allows it to ensure the secure and stable operation of that function. So I think it's the last sentence that perhaps needs to be elaborated a little bit, but that's what we were fearing, is that there might be a request to reduce the budget in some way by other parts of the community, and reducing that budget would mean that we'd fail to deliver on our commitments to deliver a secure and stable operation of that function.
Thanks very much, Bruce. And with that, I recommend we try to take stock of where we are. It looks like the essence or the notion of what's currently in paragraph 22 is well received by this group. What we should be doing is come up with a revised draft for this paragraph, which ensures, I'm using the language that Jordan Carter has been using, slightly paraphrasing what's been said here, that the operational communities should not be ignored, but that they should have a voice. We will also make sure that we don't spell out individual organizations, but just make reference to the operational communities. And we will specify that the implementation needs to be such that proper delivery of the services and of the SLAs is not jeopardized. So instead of doing wordsmithing on this as a group exercise, I noticed that there was some interaction about should, must, or other language. We should take this to the mailing list and discuss an updated draft. Since Bruce made reference to the form that the caretaker budget should take, I guess that's a nice segue to the third question in front of us, which is actually a discussion on the exact or clearer guidelines on the caretaker budget, or whether we can safely leave it to the implementation phase. You will remember that in our third draft report, we mentioned that the details are under development. There has been interaction with the CFO, Xavier, and his team. So that's work in progress. And I would like to hand it over to Jordan to offer a little bit more background on where we are with this discussion before we open up the queue that's currently forming.
Thanks. Thanks, Thomas. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you all right.
Yeah, great. Thanks. So this is on the Caretaker budget clarity point, right?
That's correct.
Just confirming. Yeah, sorry, I had a wee audio problem when you were talking. I don't actually have a lot to add to that. There's, you know, we've had a bit of a discussion just now with Bruce about what needs to be clarified in that previous point about the IANA budget. We know that there's been some work going on with Xavier about the detail of the caretaker budget and the principles and so on. To me, there isn't a lot of difference between those two options, whether we need to provide clearer guidelines in this proposal or whether we keep developing them in the implementation process. But I do want to ask if Jonathan Zuck has any thoughts to add here, because he's been a lead player in doing those discussions. And maybe if we get Shireen as well to speak on that. Personally, I don't have firm views. If we want to put more detail in this version of the report, we should get onto it quickly. If we're happy to leave it to implementation, then that's fine by me as well. Could we ask Jonathan if he wants to take a supplementary point on an initial comment?
Sure. Hi. Thanks, Jordan. I guess my feeling on the document that's been created thus far is that the principles that are in it, for the most part, are ones that the community would agree on and are pretty straightforward. There's currently in the document a lot of redundant text with text that's already in the proposal, and so it's just not a sort of refined enough document. That wouldn't be terribly difficult to do, but I also agree with Jordan that a lot of this is going to be purely logical, be dictated by contracts, et cetera, and it's the definition of the caretaker budget is really going to be largely uncontroversial and be most appropriate to the implementation phase.
Thanks very much, Jonathan, for this clarification. And since there has been a question in the chat, the question about where we are, we're actually discussing the third out of four questions to be discussed on the budget community power, the IANA budget, the caretaker budget, and there is no specific reference in the document below, but the question is rather whether this is the point that we can leave to the implementation phase. We have started this discussion, Bruce, basically with, amongst others, your intervention that we need to ensure that whenever a budget community power is invoked, that the proper delivery of the IANA services and the fulfillment of the SLAs is granted. And so maybe a way forward could be to flesh that out a little bit more, as you suggested, and leave the detail to implementation. Let's hear Cheryl now and then Shireen.
Thank you very much, Cheryl Langdonor from ALAC AP regional member. I just wanted to have a very brief intervention and remind all of you, and this is following on from Bruce's comment on the last sentence regarding the possible need for bolstering that on the aspects of the caretaker budget. For those of you who are not also engaged in the CWG work and the ongoing work of what's called DT0 or the Drafting Team Zero, which is focusing specifically on IANA budget issues, there is a lot of focus in that work continuing as we are continuing to work, they are continuing to work. There is a lot of focus in that group on this caretaker budget. I would strongly recommend we go lightly on the words, make them clear and unambiguous, but leave all the gory details to implementation, because the CWG DTO work with ICANN's accounts and finance leadership is working very, very specifically in this area, and we would possibly trip over each other. Thank you.
Thanks, Cheryl. Shireen.
So I agree with Jonathan about the approach to defining the caretaker budget, and I also agree with the comment made earlier about the second sentence in paragraph two. I think that will be good. One extra point, interested in Jonathan's response on that, that the board has made in its comment and said that the once we define the caretaker budget, the approach to it, and agree it all among ourselves, it should be then part of the fundamental bylaws, so that we create some form of stability going forward, that we don't have to reinvent the wheel every time if there is a veto by the community. So we added that recommendation on page 10 of our comments. We said that the caretaker budget, the approach to it, should be embedded in the fundamental bylaws, and including the responsibility of the CFO to establish that budget in accordance with that defined approach. Jonathan, you and I have not had this discussion on whether this should be part of the fundamental bylaw or not, but do you see any issues that I think it's a good thing to do for us as a community?
Thanks, Shireen, and I let Jonathan respond to that immediately. With conveniently raised his hand.
Yes, thanks, Shireen. That's a good question. And I mean, I have a general concern about us stuffing way too much detail into bylaws as a part of this process. And so, personally, I think if the bylaw really stuck to the language you just put out there in terms of there's a framework document that the acting CFO would use to use a caretaker budget, and the bylaw suggests that the CFO is empowered to define that budget, I think that makes sense to put into the bylaws, but I certainly wouldn't put any of the components of the framework itself into the bylaws.
Thanks very much, Jonathan.
Makes sense.
Makes sense.
Great. I wanted to ask Shireen whether that makes sense to you, and obviously looks like we have clear instructions from the group, both during oral interventions as well as in the chat, that this point is clearly for implementation, as long as we ensure that we have some general guidance in the language of the report. So we will work on that, offer it to the list, but clear message is that this is going to be for the implementation. With respect to fundamental versus standard bylaws, let's now focus our attention on the fourth out of four questions, and that is a comment that has been made by Mira and AFTOD, who were suggesting that the budget community power should be a standard bylaw. And we've heard earlier that there was a strong wish, particularly from the board, to be more explicit on making it fundamental. I would also like to direct your attention to the CWG requirements on budget. Also, we have presented the budget community power as a fundamental bylaw to the community in previous reports. So it is the co-chair's assessment at the moment that these views are minority views, not sufficient to jeopardize the overall consensus on the budget community power needing to be a fundamental bylaw. Nonetheless, we wanted to bring this point up in this group and see whether there's more traction to make it standard. But let's please not forget the points I just made, i.e. we would probably jeopardize CWG conditions as well as what I would deem overwhelming community support for the community power as a fundamental bylaw. So there's a queue forming. I'm not sure whether Jonathan's hand is an old hand. And if you are raising your hands to agree with what I've said, I think we could maybe make some time and move on. So I would really like to hear from those that are in favor of making this a standard bylaw. because that would be then probably reason to reopen the discussion at that point. Helen.
Thank you. I'm half where you said I should talk. All things being equal, if we were starting all over again, I might not want to make it a fundamental bylaw, but it is one of the powers, the powers we started off by saying will be fundamental bylaws so they cannot be revoked. And to make that change right now sounds like close to suicidal unless we have some compelling reasons. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Alan, any further contributions on this point? That does not seem to be the case, and that actually allows us to move on to the last substantive discussion point, which is going to be chaired by Mathieu.
Thank you very much, Thomas. And this is the last substantive point, but not the least. Definitely a point of discussion that we've spent a considerable amount of time already on, which is the mission statement, recommendation number 5. Becky has provided a slide deck, and I will turn over the floor to Becky for an overall presentation of this slide deck, and we will allow questions when she is gone through all these slides, so we have a broad vision for, shared between each of us. and once Becky has offered some Stroman options for clarifications and refinements that we can consider, so we can keep the discussion focused on finding a common ground way forward. And in doing this, obviously, it would be extremely helpful if we could avoid recapping previously mentioned positions and focus on considering ways forward in a constructive manner. So, Becky, with that being said, you have the floor for introducing this very easy topic. Becky.
Thank you very much. And I apologize for departing a little bit from the format that we've been using. I think that I've had the sense that people's eyes glaze over when we start talking about some of these mission statement issues, so I was going to try to make it a little bit more concrete with the deck. Can I get control over the deck, or can we move to the next slide? Okay, looks like I have control. Okay, so first of all, overall summary on the comments, and thanks very much to the staff for putting together. Most of the comments were extremely supportive of the proposed mission statement, including the clarification that articulates ICANN's limited mission and including the regulatory prohibition. That said, there were several commenters who expressed pretty strong or serious concerns. In addition to the board, obviously, we also had strong concerns expressed both by the GAC and by ALAC. So, you know, we are in a space where we have to, you know, really examine the level of consensus and resolve these issues. And I think that's doable with clarifications and understandings. Some of the commenters continue to urge for the inclusion of competition, consumer trust, and choice in the commitments and core values. That's sort of not precisely on this topic, but I included it in the deck. GAC and ALAC both sought a legal opinion on constraints on the ability, the board's ability to act on GAC advice and continuing ability to impose and enforce PICs and other negotiated registry provisions. I wrote that very carefully because I want to focus us on sort of the precise issues. And then the ICANN board continued to object to the language of the regulatory prohibition. This deck, this slide is a little bit wrong. What they did not have, they conceded that ICANN should not regulate content and should not be a regulator, but they objected on global public interest grounds to inclusion of that provision in the mission statement of ICANN. So I think that it's kind of a narrow but important objection that they made. As we have been discussing on the list, the GAC specifically stated that changes to the mission statement should not constrain the board from accepting and implementing GAC advice. Now, if we have got this right, we have not changed ICANN's mission because nobody was setting out to change ICANN's mission. So assuming that this means that, that ICANN should be able to continue to accept and implement GAC advice consistent with its mission as it has been, there's not a disagreement. But if the portent of the GAC's comments are that indeed the ICANN board should be able to implement GAC advice even if the manner in which it implements that advice is inconsistent with the bylaws, then I do think we have a sort of more fundamental divide. So as Jordan has said in the chat, and as I think various people reiterated, I think there is acceptance that the GAC can give advice on what it wants to. ICANN must engage in accordance with the bylaws, but to the extent it implements GAC advice, it must do so consistent with the limitations on mission in the bylaws. The ALAC wants assurances that the PICs and other negotiated provisions of the registry agreement and the registrar accreditation agreement remain valid, including for unsigned registry agreements, and that they may be renewed without change. As you all know, the current text prohibits the imposition of regulations on services that use the Internet's unique identifiers or the content that such services carry or provide. And, of course, that language is not included in the proposal as bylaws language, but is subject to drafting by the legal experts and subject to the drafting notes that accept that, consideration of the use of names as natural identifiers is not prohibited. Issues within the picket fence are by definition excluded from regulation, and the grandfathering provisions, more about that later. As I said, most commenters supported the current formulation, but the board objected to this language in the mission statement on public interest grounds and suggested that the permissible scope of registry agreements and the registrar accreditation agreements could be addressed in another portion of the bylaws. It didn't have a suggestion as to where, but the two obvious possible places are one in the GNSO provisions and the other in the general provisions where contracting is arranged. Next slide, the board comments continuing. The other thing that the board said is that it felt that the mission statement as currently drafted did not address ICANN's operational role. And they proposed language that would say that ICANN, they had proposed language regarding including the allocation and assignment of names in the root zone as a result of the bottom-up policies. to cover ICANN's role with respect to allocation and assignment of names. As we have seen on the list, this formulation may raise some CWG separation issues, which we should discuss. And then also, while the board asserts that ICANN is not a regulator, it feels that the current language is unclear and not appropriate for the mission statement. So just going through the specific changes in the language, I've provided a side-by-side on names. They did not propose any changes to the port parameter protocol section. They did propose some changes to the number section, which we'll talk about, and they did propose language for the root server for the RSAC portion. RSAC has said in its comments that it will propose language by the 10th of January, so I propose that we not discuss that until we hear from RSAC on that. But I can propose, the board proposed to change the reference to ICANN's mission to scope, and to say that ICANN's scope includes the coordination of the development and implementation of domain names, domain name policies, including allocation and assignment of those names in accordance with the root zone, or in accordance with those policies. And then it proposed to strike the two provisions for which uniform or coordinate resolution is reasonably necessary and the bottom-up policy development process. We have had significant conversation on the list with respect to this. I think that there are two things to notice. One, our language that we have included in both first, second, and third draft reports states that ICANN's mission or scope or role or whatever you want to call it is to coordinate as opposed to the looser statement about including the coordination. So that's one potential expansion. And then the removal of the two languages, we don't have an official board view on this. It is not, this proposed change is not something that the board suggested it had a public interest objection to. And as Bruce pointed out, this is something that ICANN has agreed to in the contracts with registries and registrars, for example, since ICANN's beginning. With respect, continuing on with specific board recommendations on names, the board does not appear to have a public interest objection to the requirement that ICANN act strictly in accordance and only is reasonably appropriate to achieve its mission, nor does it obviously have an objection to the language regarding the ability to negotiate, enter into, and enforce agreements with contracted parties in service of its mission. But what it does clearly object to, and its objection rises to the level of a public interest objection, is to the inclusion of the regulatory prohibition in the mission section of the bylaws themselves. Then with respect to sort of miscellaneous, not just the board's concerns, but concerns with respect to the text in general, the ALAC raised a question with respect to both the drafting note that read, the issues identified in Specification 1 to the Registry Agreement and Specification 4 to the Accreditation Agreement which are the so-called picket fence, are intended and understood to be within the scope of ICANN's mission. Now, the ALAC comments asserted that this implies that ICANN's mission is limited to the areas within the picket fence. I think that is a misreading both of the text of the note itself and of the, you know, the mission is very clearly set out, as we said above, with respect to names. Sorry for making everybody seasick. This is ICANN's mission. It's coordination, the development and implementation of policies for which uniform coordinated resolution is reasonably necessary, et cetera. And so I think that a reasonable reading is that the references to the picket fence in the drafting notes are for the avoidance of doubt, and they are, by their terms, without limitation, but an articulation of things that are within, but not a comprehensive articulation. So I understand ALAC's concern, but I do think, and obviously we will have time to talk about it, that there should not be any misunderstanding that the specifications themselves are a statement of ICANN's mission. ICANN's mission is in the bylaws. Going on to the miscellaneous concerns on the drafting notes, we did have the language in black on the left for the avoidance of uncertainty. We have the grandfathering. That is the language that was in the draft report. However, we subsequently on the list talked more about what this meant, and the language that I have in blue here is the result of the conversation, which basically says that, you know, the grandfathering, it means that parties that sign these agreements intend to be bound by them, and that neither a contracting party or anybody else should be able to bring a case that says these provisions on their face are outside ICANN's mission. But it doesn't modify the right of any person or entity who's materially affected, for example, by ICANN's interpretation in any particular case, from challenging whether that's within its mission. And I raise that because there are two points here. First of all, several commenters agreed with the grandfathering language, but wanted to make sure that the text that we had that we discussed after that makes clear that we're talking about facial challenges should be part of our final proposal. And ALAC has asked for assurance that negotiated language in contracts and PICs may be included in unsigned new GTLD agreements and may be renewed without change, without concerns about whether on their face they violate ICANN's mission. Now, earlier today in emails, I sent around the standard PICs, and it may be easier for us to sort of think about those than to think about the universe of the thousands of spontaneously generated PICs that are not standard, but we'll talk about some possible ways of dealing with that. Okay, so I tried to sort of set out a few questions for our conversation, and some straw people, straw propositions for to try and guide our debate. So the first one is, in what way does or should ICANN's mission statement constrain the board's ability to comply with GAC advice? And I believe that we agree that the GAC can provide advice on any matter it sees fit, and ICANN has to duly consider that advice in accordance with the bylaws. And if it decides to follow that advice, it must do so in a matter that is consistent with ICANN's bylaws, including its mission statement. So I see that we have some folks raising their hands, and I suspect we will hear from them on this. If you don't mind, I want to just quickly go through all of the kind of questions and propositions, and then we'll go back. And then the second question is, how does or should the mission statement limit the permissible scope of ICANN's agreements with contracted parties? And I think a fair reading of the language as proposed is that ICANN's agreements with contract parties may reflect bottom-up, consensus-based, multi-stakeholder policies on issues for which uniform or coordinated resolution is reasonably necessary to facilitate openness, interoperability, resiliency, security, stability of the DNS, and other provisions in service of that mission. That begs the question of who should be able to challenge whether or not a contract provision is in service of that mission and under what circumstances. And another way of putting that is, to what extent should contracted parties be free to propose or voluntarily accept and obligated to comply with, if they do accept or propose, contract provisions that exceed the scope of ICANN's mission, for example, to serve a specific community and gain the support of that community for a community application, or to proactively address a public policy concern. And in the course of our discussions, we've had this side conversation that says, okay, it's fine to say voluntary, but, you know, if you allow voluntary commitments to exceed the scope of ICANN's mission, how do you ensure that those commitments are truly voluntary? Now, I have a proposition here, and I know I'm saying in advance that I know Milton's going to disagree with me. But it's just a proposition for discussion purposes, and that is that, you know, individually negotiated commitments, such as individual one-off picks, should be deemed to be voluntary. I don't know of a way of testing in a real way whether they are or not. I know from my own experience that some of them truly are. Existing registry agreements and RAA language, including the standard picks, would be grandfathered as defined in the notes. So that means they're facially valid, they could be challenged on the basis of implementation. And that going forward, and this kind of fits in with ICANN board's suggestion that we could deal with the regulatory prohibition and the scope of contracting in a different section, that there should be, maybe we should have a mechanism that would be available to permit contracted parties to enter into agreements without waiving the right to challenge them collectively as a group, a contract provision on the grounds that it exceeds ICANN's mission and was extracted by ICANN on an other than voluntary basis. By that I mean, you know, using its unique monopoly authority here to let people add names to the root or to register names. If you're a registrar, that's a straw man that I'm putting out there for discussion purposes. I'm just trying to, you know, come up with a kind of sensible approach there. Now, I just want to say, of course, none of this would affect any individual or group's that is materially affected by a provision in excess of ICANN's mission to challenge that prohibition under the appropriate circumstances. And then finally, just this is the last slide before we get into the discussion. The ICANN board asserted that the prohibition on regulation of services is not appropriate for inclusion in the mission statement and went on to suggest that the CWG should direct the bylaws drafting team to incorporate limitations on the reach of registry and registrar contracts in another part of the bylaws. So one question is, what's the impact? What would the impact be? If the impact is acceptable, where would we put it? In the GNSO section or in the general provisions where contracting is discussed? And should it include challenge mechanism to test voluntariness? So I think we should stop there. This is really the sort of the hard part of them. These are the hard parts of the mission statements. Now, if everybody has scroll control, I don't know if they do. These last three slides are sort of the questions that I think that would move our conversation forward if we can really focus on that. So there are lots and lots of people who have their hands up. Mathieu, shall I hand this back to you to
thank you. I will try to manage that, and please be conscious of time. Obviously, this is not a final discussion on this recommendation, because there's way too much to be handled in one single meeting. But we'll go to the various speakers in the line. What I'm looking forward to is a concrete proposal on how to move this forward and find ways to address the different concerns. So, Cavuccio first, please.
Yes, Mathieu, thank you very much, and thank Betty for a very comprehensive explanation. My point is the following. One, GAC made some statement saying that the ICANN mission should not be so and so and should not make any constraint. First question, did GAC identify in the existing definitions of the mission without making changes any area that constrained the ICANN to accepting the implementation of GAC advice? And is there any language in the current bylaw that reduces providing advice by the GAC? If GAC found any area in the current language, we expect that they propose a concrete suggestion how to modify to prevent any reduction and any constraint. Because currently, they just make a statement. My problem is that how we implement this, what is the modality to do that, unless we receive a concrete proposal either from the GAC or from the group, we cannot just take into account a statement. This should not be like that. This should not be like this. How to do it? Unless you put all this language in the bylaw, which is almost impossible. And I told in my email to the GAC and others that all issues should be accepted by the CCWG. So I suggest that there should be a language to meet the requirements of GAC if there is any area that constraining the ICANN to take advice of the GAC or reducing the GAC authorities or responsibility to good advice. However, all of these things perhaps is more relevant in the Article 11 in the GAC advice, but not here in mission. But I have no problem if you find a language to do that. The second question I should like to be more quick, not to take the time of everybody. The other is that the ICANN board proposes that the mission should be precise, concise, and high level, and any other issue relating to the scope of responsibility should go to the scope, or any other activities should go to the scope. Did we find any way how to distribute this in a high level in the mission and the remaining part in the scope? I am just asking either Becky or Bruce whether there is such arrangement that reduces the difficulty and discussion, and I thank you very much for that.
Thank you very much, Cavus. Bruce?
Just go off on mute. I think Becky, I just want to just correct one thing. Becky made a number of comments that the board objected to things on public interest grounds. We didn't. We provided reasons in each case why we thought we'd like to see some change in the proposals. And then we said that, if our comments were ignored, then we would then have to consider whether there are public interest issues. So we haven't actually done that yet. But coming back to the specific comments the board has made, really what we're trying to do is, as I think Cavus articulated, is we want to keep the mission simple and clear for clarity purposes. So I think the first start of that is to have a clear sort of one-sentence description of the mission that you can use in various forums to say, we're focused on the Internet's unique identifiers, and then to have some clarity on what the scope of those responsibilities are. And we listed those. And then I think Becky's noticed there's a couple of those that limit the scope that come from a current language that we have in registry and registrar agreements. So I don't have any specific objection to including that. But the more you sort of get into detail that's very specific to the GNSO and GTLD environment, Becky, I think the best place probably is under the GNSO section of the bylaws where we're defining the role of ICANN with respect to GTLD policy development. Because at the moment, the GNSO is very generic. It just says the GNSO looks at policies related to new GTLDs, and the bylaws related to the GNSO don't really provide any constraints on where those policies can act. And I think the board's principles were, I think, aligned with the CCWG principles, as we think one of the constraints is that ICANN should not be getting into content regulation or content development. So I think in very simple terms, we'd like to see a clean, single-line statement that says this is what ICANN's mission is. We'd like to get a clear set of clarity on the current limitations of that mission, and I think we can reach agreement on what that text is. I don't have any specific objection to incorporating the lines about the consensus policy limitations, but would think that they're probably better incorporated under the GNSO section of the bylaws because they're fairly specific. And then the only other consideration is whether they're fundamental or not, and I assume that CCWG would want them to be fundamental, so I'm not quite sure how things get labelled as fundamental or not. But I think the specifics that you get into the details of what a GTLD contract can do starts to getting into more details than what you'd normally have in a mission.
Thank you, Bruce. And I think if we had agreement on that, those principles, we can leave this to implementation drafting for actually reviewing this, because otherwise it's a lot of work missing at this point. Next is Alan.
Thank you very much. I've got a number of points. I'll be brief and will elaborate if anyone cares. On the issue of consumer trust, and for the record, the ALAC was not mentioning competition and choice, but clearly they can all go together since they were mentioned that way in the AOC. Slide 3 talks about what that paragraph 3 in the AOC means. That's not a fact. That's an interpretation. And even if that's what the original drafters meant, it stands on its own basis right now, and it means what people read into it or what an IRP decides it means. So we feel very strongly that consumer trust
is indeed something that should be enshrined within ICANN's mission, and we use the term mission there carefully. We are using the term mission and violation of mission very loosely in much of this discussion. Article 1 of the bylaws includes the mission and now includes core values. The proposed version also includes commitments. Many of the potential violations we're talking about are not at all in the mission, but in the other parts of it. The one that concerns the ALAC most, and I suspect concerns the GAC, is the new provision that everything must be done bottom-up. Especially with the new GNSO policy and implementation rules that have been approved by the board, bottom-up does rule. But there's lots and lots in the contracts right now which is not bottom-up. And the fact that someone could potentially argue with it, and PICS are an example. PICS may be our policy and should have been designed bottom-up, but they weren't, and they're part of the contracts right now. And we don't want the provision that says everything, the commitment that everything must be bottom-up, to be a reason for invalidating the PICS. And the same could be true for other things that have been added over the last little while. So the calling Article 1 the mission, Article 1 is not just the mission. So you can have violations of the bylaws in Article 1 without having violations of ICANN's mission. I think that's important to remember. The reference to the picket fence, and I have no problem incorporating it in parts of the GNSO specification, the picket fence refer to policies that happen to have certain qualities that they can be changed by a PDP, but they're only particular things within contracts, and I see absolutely no need or desire to reference those within the mission. So I really feel that we need to eliminate from the mission references to things like that. And I think that is about all I wanted to say. Thank you.
Thank you, Alan. Becky wants a quick follow-up, very shortly, Becky, because we are running out of time.
Okay, just two things. First of all, Alan, no one is suggesting that we're going to reference Specification 1 and 4 in the bylaws. Those are notes to the drafters. That's what they have always been. But I take it we agree on the suggestion encapsulate the entire mission is not correct. Two, the mission, the current language that we said says that the mission is to coordinate the development and implementations of policies that fit this bill in a bottom-up manner, and it can enter into contracts in service of that mission. I think that it would help this discussion for us to be clear that what we need to talk about is the contracts in service of this mission that encompasses your PICS and the negotiated non-bottom-up issues. So I understand your concern, but I actually do think we have a handle for addressing that we have addressed it. We just have to tweak that to work.
Thanks, Becky. The queue is closed after OJ, and I'll try to conclude this item for now on. So next is Milton. Milton?
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yes, Milton, please.
Okay. All right, thank you. I think the first meta point that needs to be emphasized here is that the idea, the current basis of the mission statement has widespread consensus. It's gone through three rounds. And indeed, the principle of defining a narrow, limited mission has been discussed from the beginning and has been one of the main foundation, a pillar of the accountability process. We are not debating whether the mission should be narrow and limited. We are debating how to do that in a practical way and how to do it in a way that doesn't cause problems. So I think some of the discussions here are really kind of trying to throw the whole thing open and reopen that issue, and I think it's pretty much a closed one. I can't think of any serious challenge to the idea that ICANN should have a narrow and limited mission, And I think if you move away from that, you are going to lose so much consensus, so much support for this entire transition that the whole thing will be in trouble. Now, with that being said, I want to go to some of the more detailed points. First of all, I'd like
to
praise Vicky. What's that?
I'm just saying that we won't have time to discuss everything and conclude, so...
I have three simple points I want to make. First of all, I agree with the implication of Becky's analysis. I really appreciated her analysis on the slides that current references to stability, security, and competition are completely sufficient to cover the concerns about consumer choice and trust. Secondly, I want to address the GAC concerns about their advice. I just still have trouble. I think I've asked this question on the list several times, and I don't think I've ever gotten an answer. Maybe a recent message has answered it, but do GAC members really believe that there should be no mission limitations? Because it seems to be the implication of their concern that they could offer any advice they wanted, and if ICANN board agrees with it, that the ICANN board should follow it, regardless of mission limitations. And I'm sorry, I think that's off the table. That idea is really quite bizarre. I mean, do the governments advocating this have a constitution and laws? Are the powers of their own governments enumerated and limited? What is it that about the ICANN environment that makes you think that there shouldn't be a constitutional limitation on what ICANN can do? And finally, in terms of what is voluntary and what is not, I think this goes back to GAC advice. If a registry proposes something, a new TLD, and advice from GAC comes and says, we don't like this proposal unless they do X, and X would be requiring this registry to do something outside of ICANN's mission or requiring ICANN to enforce things that are outside of its mission, and if then ICANN says they're not going to approve this TLD unless they comply with this GAC advice, I think that's a clear case of an involuntary situation, and that is an example in which it should be challengeable, whether you call it a PICS or GAC advice or anything else. I think that's exactly what we're trying to prevent by having a defined mission. Thank you.
Thank you, Milton. And I think what I was trying to say is that we're not going to be able to close the discussion. So the kind of substantial example you're providing is certainly, I'm afraid, going to be lost on many of the attendants that are currently leaving. So, Malcolm, if you have a very concrete proposal on the way forward, I want to hear it. Otherwise, the substance of the discussion will have to go on to another call anyway. And Caboose, I had to close the queue. I'm sorry about this, Malcolm.
Yes, I agree with really most of what Milton has just said. So I will get to the concrete specifics in a view of time. I'd like to thank Becky for what she's done, and I agree with most of the categorizations and propositions that she's made. But there is one that is a problem, and that is on this notion of voluntary commitments. Now, I'm afraid the whole voluntary...
we're not doing the discussion now.
I thought you asked for a concrete proposal.
I'm asking for a concrete proposal on the way forward and the process, because people are leaving now.
Only a process,
so we can't make any decisions.
Okay. In that case, I think we need to... in terms of process, I think we need to work through those things which might be... we might reach consensus on, and separate out those things which, as Milton has just been referring to, simply, you know, there is not going to be agreement to that that proposition from that part of the community. As Milton had said earlier, certain things I think we've already moved past, and there's just going to be no chance of that. We need to identify those and remove those from consideration if we're to move forward.
Thank you, Malcolm, for being short and sorry for interrupting. Jorge's point was captured in the chat asking for an impact assessment. I would ask staff to kindly capture Jorge's points so that they can appear in the notes in the interest of time. And I would offer that this discussion really needs to be taken on to one of our calls next week, there would be a need for, I think, a specific call to start separating issues at least and clarifying the views and positions. We would ask Becky in her role as Work Party 2 rapporteurs if she would be prepared to try and organize such thing. Obviously, we'll also update in the next calls. But it's obvious that this issue is now very complex and far from finalized with the list of questions that are raised. So we'll need to find a way forward in terms of dealing with all the concerns one by one in the next few days and weeks. I'm sorry we can't really go any further at this point, but we've had a long call already. Let's keep it going on the main list and try and organize a call, which would be open to anyone, obviously, to start triaging the various items. And with that, I'll move to Leon for a last-minute announcement in AOB. Leon?
Thank you very much, Mathieu, and thank you for all who have stayed till this point in the call. And on any other business, we, the co-chairs, would like to announce that we have received reply from Theresa Swinehart for the request that we raised in our last call in regard to the face-to-face meeting in Marrakesh. And the reply from Theresa is that we have received authorization to go ahead and hold this meeting on March the 4th, so now everyone can, of course, go ahead and proceed with arranging your travel to the Marrakesh meeting. Of course, staff will be providing help along with constituency travel for those members of the CCWG traveling to the face-to-face meeting in Marrakesh, and more details will come in the list, and for now, that would be, of course, the announcement on holding our face-to-face meeting in Marrakech. So with this, I would like to thank everyone again, and this meeting is now adjourned. Thank you very much.
Thanks, everyone.
Bye.